The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of August 29th, 2016. On today's show, we'll talk about San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick's decision to sit for the national anthem and how his brand of activism is playing in the United States of America. We'll also discuss the impasse between the San Diego Chargers and their first-round draft pick Joey Bosa, who's yet to sign a contract as the start of the NFL season approaches. And Sam Miller, the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, will join us to talk about the greatest player in the history of any sport, Yankees catcher Gary Sanchez, who has 11 home runs in 22 games played in his rookie season. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
You just call me the Sanchez. I just want to get the Sanchez out of the way now and not return to it ever.
All right. Done. And sitting in for Mike Pesca this week and joining us from a soundproof booth in Patrick Peterson's mom's TV room, it's ESPN The Magazine senior writer Mina Kimes. Hello, Mina.
Hey, guys.
And in our bonus segment this week, well, first, let me say this. We're looking for a new intern. If you're in Washington, D.C., and you're available on Mondays, you like to do a little research for the podcast, email us at hangup@slate.com, and we will make things happen. So, Mina, we've had you back because you are Hang Up and Listen returning champion, but also you've been kind of taking an extended victory lap on social media about how right you were about Ryan Lochte.
Yes, I have. Also in our emails, I specifically requested to return to, take a victory lap, basically, about how incredibly right I was. In the heat of the moment, as the news was unfolding, I made the right call.
So that's the lesser known fifth leg of the individual medley, the victory lap, just done in whatever style the victor wants. In this case, the style is the Slate Plus bonus segment. So in our bonus segment for members, we will revisit the Lochte scandal, swim Ghazi, and Mina will take her victory lap, and we'll talk about the things I was right about, too.
Yeah, because Mina didn't want to take the loser lap for going all pro South Korea in the Little League World Series final yesterday against the U.S. of A.
You know what? Okay, so I'm half Korean, so as I said, I was half happy, but let's be real, I was rooting for Korea.
To hear more of what Mina was right and wrong about, sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/hangup plus. You get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts, and you can get a 2-week free trial to just revel in the victory lap if you so desire. On Friday in Santa Clara, California, 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick did not stand with his teammates during the national anthem, the playing therein. Kaepernick hadn't stood for the anthem during the Niners' previous two preseason games, as it's a sign of his status with the team that nobody had noticed because he was not dressed out for those first two preseason games due to a shoulder injury. This time, Pro Football Talk did notice. When asked why he'd stayed on the bench, Kaepernick told NFL media, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies on the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." On Sunday, he talked at great length about this in the 49ers locker room, answering every question that the press threw his way. And let's listen to a clip.
Continue to sit?
Yes, I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
Specifically, what would you like to see?
There's a lot of things that need to change. One specifically is police brutality. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. That's not right by anyone's standards.
So, Mina, the response to this has been enormous. And, you know, I've seen some people say that this is the perfect controversy for Twitter because you don't have to know anything or hear anything to have an opinion about whether a black athlete who's the backup quarterback on the 49ers, who's making tens of million dollars a year, has the right to not stand for the national anthem. But the response has been very interesting from players, from coaches, from the league, and not entirely predictable.
Yeah, I think what's remarkable is the amount of players coming forth, and especially out of the Niners locker room. There's been a lot of quotes over the past few days with players saying, you know, Kaepernick, they had a team meeting and he sort of sat everyone down and talked to him about why he had done this and how he felt about it. And there are players coming saying, oh, before he did this, I would have opposed it. But afterwards, you know, he really made me think about criminal justice in America and these issues. White players, which is remarkable because that very rarely happens in the NFL.
And yet on the other side, you have your Rex Ryans and you have players saying, I disagree with him doing this and not even supporting his right to do it. And of course, the reaction on Twitter from idiots has been also predictable, conflating Kaepernick's performance in the last couple of seasons to his rights to do whatever he wants, to have this position and to make these statements. What triggered all of this is, of course, the national anthem. I mean, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, other athletes have been very outspoken. We've had a couple on the show in the last couple of months about the state of race relations in the United States, about police brutality, about Black Lives Matter, about these issues that have become so prominent in culture and in the presidential campaign. But the focus here is this song and its place in American sports culture and American sports history.
Yeah, and I think what makes Colin Kaepernick's protests maybe stand out from what we've seen from athletes over the last few years is what he's saying is these issues bother me so much, they touch my life and the life of people who look like me so much that I'm going to take a stand that people are going to be very angry about because I don't feel patriotic, because I don't believe this anthem represents me. And, you know, I think that sometimes you have to do something that makes people angry in order to sort of create this sort of conversation around it. I mean, the conversation around what Colin Kaepernick did has been so much bigger, broader, and more dramatic, I think, than anything instigated by an athlete thus far.
Yeah, Andrew Hawkins talked about this when he was on our show a while back and saying that if you're not uncomfortable in the protest that you're making, then that's a problem. Then you're not putting yourself out there to a degree that you should be. And that is interesting in the context of Kaepernick, because looking back now, the way that Carmelo Anthony and LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Paul disseminated their message, and this is, I'm not intending this to criticize those guys, but
it was safe.
It was safe. Like putting a photo on Instagram of, you know, Muhammad Ali, especially when Ali's image has been so kind of sanitized and he's really a saint and people aren't really thinking about how controversial and recognizing how controversial he was at the time. He was the Colin Kaepernick of his day, I think, is how we should
remember him.
But also NBA fans are, I think, more black and younger as a demographic, and those players are more popular and I think, you know, certainly not above criticism, but less in a position to be criticized in the way Kaepernick has been. And then choosing the national anthem as a target, as Mina did, you open yourself up to, you're not supporting the troops, you hate America. And so that's why it doesn't take a player who's, you know, the most famous or the best to become a lightning rod. Oh, I should also mention the WNBA. I think those players all had like incredible skin in the game and were making a huge statement, but people don't care as much about the WNBA, to state the obvious.
Right. Well, you think about the protests historically in sports that have resulted in the athlete being vilified. And you can go back to, say, Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar refusing to play for the Olympic team in the 1960s. Think about Jackie Robinson. Someone posted on Twitter Jackie Robinson quotation that was repeated in Jonathan Eig's book, Opening Day, about Robinson. He wrote this as a preface to one of his autobiographies in 1967. And he says, I'm just going to read it. There I was, the black grandson of a slave, the son of a black sharecropper, part of a historic occasion, a symbolic hero to my people. The air was sparkling, the sunlight was warm, the band struck up the national anthem. The flag billowed in the wind. It should have been a glorious moment for me as the stirring words of the national anthem poured from the stands. Perhaps it was, but then again, perhaps the anthem could be called the theme song for a drama called The Noble Experiment. Today, as I look back on the opening game of my first World Series, I must tell you that it was Mr. Ricky's drama and that I was only a principal actor. As I write this 20 years later, I cannot stand and sing the anthem. I cannot salute the flag.
I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but before this happened this weekend and all these stories came out, I had no idea about the history of the anthem in sports and, you know, what it meant. And ESPN had done a story about how I think the first time that the anthem was played at a baseball game, it was to gin up ticket sales, right?
So yeah, it was during the World Series in 1918.
From the beginning and corrupted, I think, in its messaging. I had no idea. And it's funny because I think not standing for the anthem, you can be angry about it for two reasons. You can say he's not a patriot, he's not supporting our country, and yeah, that's what he's saying. That is the natural endpoint of saying you don't agree with what a government is doing and you don't feel like it affords you the same liberties as other people who live in the country. The other argument is that it's anti-military, which A, he did clarify and say this is not about the military, but B, it really got me thinking how weird it is that we do have this like right before sports games where we honor the military. Is that the best way to express support for the military? Also in the NFL, which as we know, has taken payments from the military to promote the military before games.
Yeah, the anthem has become a sine qua non for sporting events in the United States. It's just weird. And Mina, you alluded to the start of this. It happened in 1918 during the World Series. The U.S. was entering World War I. Players were being conscripted into the army. There had been a bombing of the Chicago Federal Reserve a few days before the first game of the series to be played in Chicago. The Cubs, who were in the series against the Red Sox, decided to move the series from their smaller Wrigley Field, which didn't have as many seats then, to Comiskey Park, which had 30,000 seats. And ticket sales were slow because of these issues going on in society. And they played the national anthem, and it turned out to be a hit. Fans were into it. And 27,000 people showed up at game two instead of 19,000 at game one. And it took a while, but it then became this tradition as owners realized this was a way to goose the public into caring about the game by uniting these two things, patriotism and sports.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly moments in American history when games, sporting events, even when it's not Team USA, when there is kind of a legitimate feeling of patriotism in the stands. You think about after 9/11, sure. You know, with the Mike Piazza home run, or, you know, in that game in 1918, it seems like maybe there is a legitimate reason for the playing of the national anthem for people to feel patriotic. But I think what's great about what Kaepernick did is that the national anthem has become perfunctory, and we don't think about why it's played. We don't think about why God Bless America has become this staple of the seventh inning stretch. And it's great to, you know, have an occasion to step back and actually think about why these things have become staples of our games and whether they should be. And there was a piece on The Intercept by John Schwartz that points out like the obvious point that the Star Spangled Banner was written when slavery was, you know, legal in the United States.
And during the War of 1812.
And the third verse of the Star Spangled Banner, and, you know, there are all these verses of songs we just don't know exist, but we should know exist. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave, and the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave, or the land of the free and the home of the brave. That's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. No refuge could save the hireling and slave, or the land of the free and the home of the brave.
I had no idea. That's like when you play Pink Floyd's album backwards and it's a satanic or is that Led Zeppelin? Am I confusing? The idea of all of these like American famous songs having like racist B-sides is somehow entirely unsurprising to me.
Well, and the other issues that get conflated here, that we play the national anthem because sports reflect how great we are as a country, and sports are also a proxy for war. And I don't totally buy that. I think it's more about American exceptionalism, that our sports matter so much that they represent our country and our country only. And Canada, we're going to make you guys sing O Canada at hockey games too. And I don't know if there's actually a separate tradition in Canada, and that's why O Canada is sung. But it sure feels that way. And to not allow or to be against the notion of protesting against the national anthem is ludicrous. I mean, I mentioned Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, Ali also didn't go to fight in Vietnam because he was protesting the government. He didn't like things that were happening in the government. 53 years ago on Sunday was the March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Who joined that march? Who marched on Washington? The reigning NBA MVP, Bill Russell, was part of that. So the idea that an athlete can't oppose the direction of or things that are happening in government is not something that is new to Colin Kaepernick. It is something that is important in the history of sports in America.
It's interesting how many of the critiques of Kaepernick have also not engaged at all with his points or the issues he's bringing up, but have simply kind of argued, oh, well, he did it wrong, unlike XYZ athlete, or many of them have gone after his character, oh, he did this in the past, oh, we've heard that song before, right? Or he's too wealthy, which is crazy, he somehow profited this country. Also, people saying, oh, well, he's not good at football anymore and he's trying to be relevant again. A, this is pretty much the worst thing you can do as an athlete to regain some semblance of like popularity. And B, like that is actually what makes this all the more remarkable to me, because in the NFL, if you're really good and talented and have a secure roster position, you can kind of say whatever you want and do whatever you want. As we've learned, Colin Kaepernick is not in that position. He is very much on the bubble of being a starter in San Francisco, and yet he's gone out on a limb here. And that makes it all the more remarkable to me.
Yeah. Just to get a little bit more into the substance or lack thereof of the critique here, Fox Sports, which is not particularly slowly turning into, you know, the Fox News of sports. On one side, you had Clay Travis, who was kind of exulting on Twitter all weekend about how he destroyed Colin Kaepernick and how Colin Kaepernick is a moron. Basically, his point was that there's no problem for black people in America. So that was kind of one side of it. And then Jason Whitlock, on the other side, his argument, he had this coinage twoke that was Colin Kaepernick saw something on Twitter, or he's like 140 characters worth of aware about history. So that idea, to boil it down, is he's too stupid to or too ignorant to protest, which I thought was interesting. You know, if we're not going to be able to litigate the entire history of America on this podcast, unfortunately. But if you just look at the Bay Area, San Francisco Police Department, racist, like horribly bigoted racist text messages. This scandal happened within the last year. You know, I could read a few of these. It's worth every penny to live here away from the savages, talking about Walnut Creek. These guys are pretty stupid. Ask some dumbass questions you would expect from a black rookie. Sorry if they're your buddies. Do you celebrate Kwanzaa at your school? Yeah, we burn the cross on the field. Then we celebrate whiteness. And, you know, we also probably don't have time to get into the Oakland, you know, sex scandal that's led to, you know, a bajillion different leadership changes in that police department. So just the idea that you don't have the right to protest because, you know, you make too much money, as Mina said, or because there really aren't any problems with the police in America. Like, Come on, dude.
Well, and the way the dumb white columnists parse it is also reflective of what's going on here. Mina, you identified some dude in Houston at the Houston Chronicle named Brian T. Smith, who in, you know, an idiotic column, defended Carlos Delgado when he refused to stand for God Bless America in 2004 because he opposed a war, quote, not enough Americans truly believed in. And he defended Carmelo Anthony and Dwayne Wade for creating important conversations. But Kaepernick is like a selfie in the Instagram age. It really is. It's the Jason Whitlock argument that he's not smart enough and this is just a social media behavior intended to draw attention to him.
What's amazing about Kaepernick, too, coming out on Sunday and speaking at great length, not just to his teammates, but also to reporters, is he doesn't do that, guys. Like, Colin Kaepernick has had a very – he's had a roller coaster of a career. It's been, you know, with extreme highs and extreme lows. But throughout all of that, he's been pretty reticent. He doesn't talk a lot. He's not a Richard Sherman. He's not out there doing press conferences. So for him to wait – kind of bide his time, then come out and do this, and then follow it up with a long, eloquent sort of expression of his feelings, that says a lot.
Except I think we should also point out that he also said about the presidential election, you have Trump, who's openly racist. We have a presidential candidate who has deleted emails and done things illegally and is a presidential candidate. That doesn't make sense to me, because if that was any other person, you'd be in prison. So maybe not. Maybe not completely aware.
Jill Stein endorsement just around the corner with Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, I mean, I think the eloquence is a little bit beside the point. Just this idea that you need to pass some sort of test to be able to stand up and say what you believe in. Or, I mean, it's fine to point out the stuff that he says that is, you know, stupid, or if you believe that it's stupid. But I do think that it's been heartening, especially from the players, that people have said, you know, it's fine for him to do this, for him to stand up for what he believes in. And I feel like, you know, MMQB, which is kind of the font of conventional wisdom, Peter King did a poll, and I think it was like 2/3 of people that he polled said that Kaepernick was wrong, that he shouldn't have done what he did. But maybe it's just like, because my bar is so low, I've still been surprised that the response has been as positive as it has been. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree.
I think that poll was also Peter King just asking people to reply to a tweet. So
that's scientific.
Like, yeah, if like the presidential election was decided by YouTube commenters or something.
Yeah, fair enough. But, you know, Kaepernick has been subjected to, I think there's no other way to say it, but extremely racist criticism throughout his career. Yeah. Robert Klimko, also on MMQB, pointed out a column that was written in 2012 about how Kaepernick had, you know, a lot of tattoos, and you can't be a quarterback on a team and be the CEO or face of the organization if you have tattoos, and compared him to Michael Vick because, hey, that's a black guy who played quarterback who has tattoos. They must be exactly the same. Mm-hmm. There's also that meme that went around about comparing Colin Kaepernick to Russell Wilson and how Kaepernick has photos on Instagram that show him with tattoos, and Russell Wilson has photos, you know, of himself, you know, washing Mina's car. And,
I would just like to point out that I never circulated that meme, Josh.
And, you know, visiting sick kids in hospitals. So even if you kind of separate out the like bigger picture issues, you can imagine that Colin Kaepernick is probably fed up with, you know, white sports writers telling him how he should behave and, you know, what's, you know, appropriate, and judging him based on, you know, not the things that he says, but just how he looks.
Yeah, I mean, Colin Kaepernick's biography is so wrapped up in this entire story. You know, he was adopted by white parents, and this is something that has been sort of thrown in his face almost his entire career. You know, you had Rick Riley writing a column about it when he was a rookie. And so for him to go through
Rick
that...
Rick Riley saying that Kaepernick was basically being an asshole for not wanting to be in touch with his birth parents.
And then following up more recently with a tweet when there were rumors about Colin Kaepernick being traded to Denver, about how that would, I think, be awkward because his birth mother lives there, or something incredibly inappropriate, but possibly the worst tweet of the year, to be honest. But anyways, you know, this guy has been really dragged by the media, the white media, for his entire career. So that, I think, goes a long way to explaining his stance today and why he's willing to speak out about it.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, Josh Levine here, the host of the show. Remember me? So we recorded the following segment on Joey Bosa and the Chargers and their contract impasse on the morning of Monday, August 29th. Naturally, inevitably, due to the laws of pre-recorded podcasts, the Chargers and Joey Bosa agreed to a contract after we finished taping this segment. So a couple facts you should know going into this. Bosa ended up getting a fully guaranteed signing bonus, and the Chargers ended up getting offset language, which means that if they cut him in year four of the deal, they won't have to pay out all the money that is in his contract. That'll probably make more sense once you listen to the segment. So the important thing to know is Joey Bosa and the Chargers screwed us over by signing this deal immediately after we finished the segment. But you should still listen to the segment because we got some larger points about football and money and contracts. Am I convincing you? I think it was a good segment. And really, the team, the Chargers and Bosa, they should have come to this deal a long time ago. Still stupid. All right, here we go. Back in April, the San Diego Chargers selected Ohio State defensive end Joey Bosa with the number 3 pick in the NFL draft, while every other first-round pick signed a contract with his new team a very long time ago. Bosa and the Chargers have yet to come to an agreement, and the Chargers went so far as issuing a press release last week announcing to the world that they had made their best offer to Bosa, that it had been rejected by the player's representative, and that the team was pulling it off the table. The nutty thing here is that the NFL's collective bargaining agreement essentially makes it so that these rookie deals are pre-written, that first-round picks all get four-year contracts with an option for a fifth year, that each slot in the draft is associated with a particular amount of money. Writing for the MMQB, Andrew Brandt says a union executive once told him a trained monkey could do these contracts. And yet, in a piece for Bleacher Report, Mike Freeman wrote that other NFL general managers are laughing at the Chargers for ruining Bosa's rookie season for no good reason. Stefan, the dispute here is just over incredibly small things, it seems to me. It's about what percentage of Bosa's signing bonus should be upfront and what percentage should be deferred for just a couple of months. And then the other one is about something called offset language, which is in the very kind of off chance that Bosa gets cut by the team before his contract is over,
5 years,
whether the team would have to pay his remaining salary.
Right.
So explain, why is there a dispute here?
Well, there's a dispute here because the Chargers are notoriously and historically penurious. They have screwed over players multiple times in the past, and they're basically trying to end around the NFLPA's agreement and the NFL's agreement, the way that rookies have been treated. From what I understand, most rookies don't get both of those concessions. The rookies that are getting the huge deals, the top 10 picks, they don't get both the offset language waived and they don't get all of the bonus right up front. But Joey Bosa is the third pick in the draft. And if you want to go anti-Bosa and you say, well, he should be grateful he's getting $25 million in bonus money, well, yeah, sure, but that doesn't mean he deserves to not have that money when traditionally top picks get that money so that he can invest it and behave the way normal people behave when they get their money. And the offset language seems pretty picky, too, because the likelihood, well, it's hard to say in the NFL, but the likelihood of him being cut in year four isn't super high, and him going to another team and the Chargers being on the hook for that money. And the other anti-Chargers part of this is that they've negotiated publicly and Bosa's agent has not. Bosa's agent has been pretty diplomatic in terms of the statements that he's made on behalf of his client.
Bosa's mom and this
has been less discreet.
Yeah, she said on Facebook that she wished that they had pulled an Eli Manning, meaning Manning was drafted by the Chargers in 2004 and demanded a trade to the Giants.
That's some good mom right there.
So let's look at the data on this. 18 of the 24 top five picks over the last 4 years have gotten one of the two things that Joey Bosa is asking for here, which is either no offsets or getting their signing bonus in this calendar year. The last two third overall picks, which is where he was taken, Blake Bortles and Dante Fowler Jr., both got deals with no offsets. Now, Stefan mentioned that the Chargers are negotiating publicly, which, by the way, is really crazy and unprecedented. I think that is really thrown people. So they've come out and said a couple of things about his deal, which I thought were a little bit misleading. One, they're saying, well, this has never happened before, you know. Well, yeah, they haven't had a top 10 pick since 2004. So they're comparing him to picks that they've had that have been much, much less talented.
Yeah, they're saying, we've never paid anyone as much money as this. Well, yeah, because you haven't been in position to pay anyone as much.
Yeah, and then they're saying, oh, he has a bigger signing bonus. Yeah, he's the third round pick. Like, it's totally illogical. And it really puts the Chargers in a bad light. You know, you mentioned his mom. What she tweeted was an article. I can't remember what it was, something about how the Chargers have been cheap in the past. I can't remember the headline. But they really do have a history of doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, look at the holdouts. Eli Manning, LaDainian Tomlinson, Quentin Jammer. There are more. Sean Merriman held out. Phillip Rivers held out the year that he was traded for Manning in the draft. So the history here isn't that the Chargers are somehow reasonable and they're drafting bad people. It's that these are athletes with agents that want to be treated fairly. I mean, they are signing up to play a game that is likely to shorten their lifespan. They deserve to get what other players of the same caliber have gotten.
So the Joey Bosa contract negotiation, as fascinating as it is, I think would not support a much longer discussion on this podcast. But I think two larger points that are interesting are, despite the fact that the Chargers do have a well-earned reputation for being penurious, it seems like the fans, and I'm going to now cite a poll, the one poll done in America that's less scientific than the Peter King Twitter poll. In the San Diego Union Tribune, they cited a poll done by a sports radio station that said 84% of people who responded were pro-Chargers. And the Union Tribune, there's a guy, Kevin Acey, who I think I've read him before. I think he's a smart guy, like, generally, wrote this column that is like crazily anti-Bosa and pro-team.
The other columnist did too, John Canepa.
And just the point here is just how powerful and generally well-received the message is that players are being greedy still to this day. I think it's changed somewhat in, you know, the last 5, 10, 20 years since, you know, the advent of free agency or whatever.
The speed that these sorts of stories accelerate to the point of, does Joey Bosa want to play in the NFL? Does he want to be a Charger? He doesn't want to be a Charger. And John Canepa, another columnist in San Diego, Bosa's being offered quarterback money. He's never played a down. We have no idea if he's going to be good or bust. Well, no shit. We have no idea whether any NFL player is going to be good or a bust, or whether he is going to bust immediately.
That's also not quarterback, buddy. Can we just say, like, that's insane? But yeah, I mean, we root for teams, not for players. And we root for teams that play in a league with a salary cap. So naturally, fans and, you know, the voices who speak on their behalf do tend to align with ownership. But when you look at the conversation around this, so we were talking about the offsets earlier, it's being described by a lot of people in the press, and I think, you know, agents as well, or teams, as double dipping. So, well, let's look at what this actually is. What an offset is the Chargers saying, okay, we're guaranteeing we're going to give you $25 million, which I think is his contract. Right. If you sign with another team in your fourth year, we cut you and you sign, and they give you $6 million and we owed you $8 million, then we only have to give you $2 million. They're basically saying we don't deserve to take on any risk. How is that a player double dipping? Yet that's the word we're using to describe what it is.
The other larger point I wanted to make here is that in November, there is a ballot initiative in San Diego for the public financing of a new stadium that, if approved, will keep the Chargers in town. They were one of the three teams that applied to move to Los Angeles and that's been put on hold pending this ballot initiative. The proposal is $650 million in financing from the team and the NFL, $1.15 billion in bonds, $350 million city contribution, $600 million for convention center, $200 million to acquire land. And so when you juxtapose what the Chargers are asking for from the people of San Diego, from the city, from voters, with this contract negotiation with Bosa, it's even more bizarre to me that Chargers fans would be on the side of the team here. And again, shows Mina's point that we root for teams blindly and dumbly, and I would put myself in that category too.
But I think it's also something that is very specific, or at least more heightened, with the NFL. I mean, to go back to Colin Kaepernick, you know, the opprobrium dumped on Kaepernick has something to do with the nature of National Football League fans, that there is this sort of this greater blind loyalty to the institution. It's, you know, the NFL has done a great job of co-opting the public into making the public believe that they are proxy defenders of the shield. And I think that's what we see in, you know, that's what we're seeing here with the defense of the Chargers. And, you know, but I mean, who knows whether the public is going to pass this referendum. I mean, cities have turned down these referenda in the past. So I'm not sure that, you know, when you get past the small slice of the public that are devoted NFL fans, whether that loyalty will translate.
Sure.
Well, let me make an appeal to Chargers fans on a football basis. If you don't care about players' rights, if you're only team, or as Steph said, Chargers first, you should be angry with the team here, because this was a terrible defense last year. They were awful. They were ranked like last in adjusted sack rate, and they're wasting Phillip Rivers' career, in my opinion. So you've got this number three pick, and he's about to make a very complicated position switch, and they're going to use him in a very complicated way. And because this team is so greedy that they won't just give him a signing bonus or whatever, you're not going to have him playing his best. You should be angry with this on a football basis.
One last thing, which I'd be curious for your comment on, Mina, is just the willingness of veteran players and leagues, and this is a baseball thing, an NBA thing, and a football thing, to just sell out rookie players. Talked about him getting quarterback money. The last guy who got quarterback money was Sam Bradford, who I think got $75 million under the previous CBA as the number one pick. And there's just this outrage from fans. You know, the Glenn Robinson contract in the NBA, when he got, I think, $100 million or more, around $100 million, as an unproven guy who'd never done it in the pros as the number one pick. That's really been drummed out of all of the sports. And so you have these guys like Bosa, like whoever else is taken in the NFL, having incredibly productive years earlier in their career before they're comprehensively injured and getting paid not very much for it. So if we step back just a little bit and rethink team friendliness a little bit, just what a great deal the Chargers are getting to have a player who will likely be as valuable as Bosa will be for the amount of money they're not willing to pay. I mean, that just makes it more silly.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy how little money these players are getting coming into the NFL post-CBA. And when you consider that, how little this issue is. And it really, you know, we talk about, oh, this is offsets, a little thing, it's one player. But these things add up. You know, in the last CBA, a little thing was the fifth-year option. Well, that has a huge trickle effect throughout the league. So all of these little moves, they move the needle further and further towards management. So Joey Bosa standing up for this, and I really do think he'll probably give in because he has no leverage here, but it does matter.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before a couple of weeks ago, Gary Sanchez was best known as the fictional Paraguayan entrepreneur and financier who heads Adam McKay and Will Ferrell's production company. Now, a different, allegedly real Gary Sanchez has risen to fame in the Bronx. On Saturday, the New York Yankees 23-year-old Dominican catcher hit his 11th home run in the 22nd game of this season, the 23rd game of his career, making him the fastest to 11 home runs in Major League history. The joys of arbitrary endpoints. As Deadspin put it over the weekend, Gary Sanchez is more or less Babe Ruth right now, which is a more delightful comparison for Yankees fans than, say, Shane Spencer or Kevin Moss, both of whom started their careers with amazing hot streaks before cooling off for the rest of their lives.
I don't think that's fair to Shane Spencer.
Why not?
He played for a while. Kevin Moss.
He cooled off for the rest of his life. That is eminently fair. Joining us now to adjudicate all of this, it's Sam Miller, the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus and the co-host of the podcast Effectively Wild, who I will now ask to put down the chisel he is using to carve Gary Sanchez's Hall of Fame plaque. Hello, Sam.
I don't think it's fair to say arbitrary endpoints either. Only one of the endpoints is arbitrary. The first one is not arbitrary. The start of your career is fairly non-arbitrary, in my opinion.
That's a great fact check already. Thank you, Sam. So the question here is, how can you tell, or can you tell, if a baseball phenom is a certified, genuine baseball phenom?
Well, I mean, the thing about Gary Sanchez, and I'm perfectly willing to take either position on this, so just let me know if you need somebody to be bullish.
Both.
All right. The thing about him is that we've only seen him play in the majors for 96 plate appearances, but we've seen him as a professional baseball player forever. Gary Sanchez is like the longest standing prospect in baseball.
He was signed at age 16.
He was signed at age 16. He was a $3 million bonus player from the Dominican Republic, and everybody knew him even then. He was probably the second best guy on the market at the time, and ever since then, he's been a top 100 prospect. He has been at Baseball Prospectus a top 100 prospect 5 years in a row, which we speculated earlier this year was possibly a record, and we haven't done the research to check that, but I think he might be the only player who's been a top 100 prospect. Well, I shouldn't say the only, but I don't think anybody's ever done six, and now neither will he, because he'll lose his rookie status. So Gary Sanchez has been around forever, and so it's not like we're dealing with Toe Nash here, where we have to figure out who this guy is who came in from the cornfields. He is a player with 3,000 minor league plate appearances who has probably had, I don't know, something on the order of 4,000 scouting reports written on him in his career. He's probably been written about on Baseball Prospectus more than Cole Calhoun. So he's not a total mystery. All of those words put together tell you that he's probably going to be a really good player, and he's probably not going to slug 900.
So what happened? Like, why did it take this long? And B, what is the switch that flipped on?
Well, I'm generally, okay, so if you look at the best months that any player has had this year in Major League Baseball, speaking of arbitrary endpoints, Sanchez has the best month of anybody. But if you look at the guys after him, it's Charlie Blackmon, DJ LeMahieu, Tyler Naquin, Anthony Rizzo, Brandon Moss. So Rizzo's a superstar. Blackmon's very good. But, you know, this happens for a month. Like, Brandon Moss is not, like, nobody's, like, buying futures in Brandon Moss right now. And so there's something about variance in baseball that I think is just stronger than in any other sport. And it's mysterious, and we don't know what to make of it. And over the course of 86 plate appearances, literally anybody can do literally anything. And if it weren't coming at the start of Sanchez's career, and, you know, if there weren't other factors at play that make us pay more attention to it, we would probably, I mean, we look, I was just about to say we would probably be skeptical of this, but we are. Everybody's skeptical of this, right? Nobody thinks that Gary Sanchez is going to hit, 11 home runs every 20 games for the rest of his life. He's in a hot streak. And so that's the downside. The more promising way of looking at it is that catchers tend to develop irregularly. They tend to develop a little bit later, a little less linearly. They have a lot of work to do, not just on their hitting, but with their catching, with their catching technique, with dealing with pitching staffs, and with the physical strain of being a catcher. And it is possible that Sanchez has made a leap forward. I think one of the things that's most interesting about Sanchez right now is not the hitting, which is very interesting, but that his defense has been really good. The knock on Sanchez for all of these years was that he doesn't have a great body, that he's something of an apathetic defender, that maybe his work ethic wasn't all that great, and that he would be a guy who would hit enough to play in the majors, but he might never have all those skills to catch in the majors. And what we've seen is actually a very good defensive catcher. He rates as, even going back to his recent minor leagues, he rates as one of the better pitch framers in the game. He's been excellent throwing out runners. And there's a possibility that he is just a guy who woke up one day and was just better at everything he does, that he woke up a better person. Well, and that happens in baseball.
Or that he woke up and wasn't 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20 years old. He's only 23 years old, and he was playing in the New York Yankees farm system. And the Yankees, over the last 20 years, have not exactly been willing to bring up potential players, good players, and displace players that they're paying between $10 and $25 million a season to perform. And finally, I mean, and this is the confluence of events. They were hovering at around 500, and Brian Cashman, finally, with the approval of the Steinbrenner family, was given the green light to ditch, trade, acquire prospects, and promote players like Gary Sanchez.
Yeah, I guess that's my question about the Yankees more broadly. You know, for so many years, they've been kind of like your friend who is rich but not that smart. So you can always be like, oh, this is my friend. He's actually kind of dumb, but he has a lot of money. I don't know. But now all of a sudden it's like, wait, no, you can't be both of these things. So do you feel like Gary Sanchez and Aaron Judge and I think Gleyber Torres, the prospects they've gotten, do they signify this change that everyone's talking about? Is it real? Are we actually seeing a change in identity?
I think that it's never been clear whether they were smart or not. I think a lot of people have considered Brian Cashman to be, in some sense, a wasted GM, because there is a feeling, I think, that he's smart and that he's got a smart front office around him, but that they weren't really ever allowed to play the game, the front office game, the smart way, or the way that we like it, the way that we sort of applaud.
Yeah, the modern way.
Because he didn't have to. They could just go out and buy whatever they needed. And it got to a point, I think, where the cycle of that purchasing caught up to them, and they really had no choice. And they tried to get out of it a couple of years ago by getting under the luxury tax threshold, and it was sort of a mess and disaster. And they get another chance at it right here. It was, I think that there was a feeling among even some smart Yankees fans that they were kind of hoping that they didn't do too well in June or July, because it was obvious that they had some valuable parts that they could move. And sort of reset and reboot. And they did it. And if you look at this team right now, they are a team that is much less like the 2000s Yankees, and more like we see with the Cubs and the Red Sox, where they're building a team that is going to be sustainable because they have this great farm system. They have a lot more youth. They still have some salaries that are going to be burdensome, but those are mostly going away in the next year or two, and they're going to be poised when the big free agents hit in 2 years to have a lot of money and a very young core. I think, if anything, that is not necessarily that Brian Cashman has learned anything. I think he was there all along. It's just that these external forces kind of finally forced them or cleared the way for them to do the thing that GMs always want to do, which is build a great young core that can win for a decade.
The thing that I always find really funny about these hot streaks, particularly around guys who are just up from the minors, is that after, whether it's the fourth home run or the eighth or the 12th, then you start seeing all these stories where, like, they're going to start throwing in breaking balls. It's like, oh, why didn't you think of that on the first game? Is there actually this notion, Sam, that when a guy comes up from the minors, it's like we have to throw him all fastballs until he hits 11 home runs?
No, there's not. I think that there is a default belief that all baseball players are weak in the same way. They can't hit inside fastballs and outside breaking balls, particularly when paired together. So if you are the rare phenomenon who can do that, who can hit those things, then I guess there is an adjustment period. And certainly they refine the approach that they take against you. But no, the idea that like they've just been treating him like he's a, you know, pitcher, a batting in the National League is crazy. And I one time looked at this with, I think, Yasiel Puig to see whether young players are actually worse at hitting breaking balls than veterans, and it's not the case. And I think I even looked at whether they get pitched differently, and I think that was not the case. I think that the adjustment thing is vastly overblown. There will be some adjustments on both sides at some point in the next few years, but for the most part, he's just really hot. Like, that's all there is to it. It's not that he's probably seen, like, he's walking, so it's not like they're throwing him a ton of fastballs down the middle. They're clearly pitching him carefully at this point. He's just really, really hot. It happens. It's, like, not necessarily predictive of a great career. I mean, there are lots of things about Gary Sanchez right now that suggest a very good career. And probably the most basic one is actually just that he's playing. I went from 65 to 2005. If you look at all the catchers who got at least 100 plate appearances through age 23, it's not a very big group because catchers tend to develop late. They tend to spend more time in the minors. And so only 100 catchers have made 100 plate appearances through age 23, which Sanchez is about to pass. And of those 100, half of them would end up making an All-Star game. Simply being in the majors at this point is enough to feel really good about him as a player. The fact that his defense has been not just credible, but quite good so far is enough. And we know he's going to hit. Like, again, we have 3,000 plate appearances on him in the minors. He is a guy with great bat-to-ball skills. He makes good contact. He's strong. He doesn't have a lot of loft, and so he doesn't generally hit a ton of homers. But he's a good hitter who's demonstrated that he's a good hitter. And he's in the middle of the hottest 3 weeks of his life, and it's fun to watch and probably doesn't actually change his outlook all that much, unless you want me to go through the long list of major leaguers who had 20 good games at the start of their career.
So let's talk about a guy who's a month and a half older than Gary Sanchez. He's ancient, and that is Bryce Harper. We had a Bryce Harper segment earlier this year on the podcast when Harper was in the middle of a Sanchezian hot streak at the start of his season, and he has tailed off miserably. Like, he's been bad, I think, for most of the season after that hot start. He had this amazing, one of the best all-time seasons last year at age 22, Sam. So at what stage do we start to reevaluate who Harper is? Do we start to look at maybe this is due to like some terrible injury? Like, how do you assess what's been going on with him this season?
Well, first of all, he's hitting 400 in the past 2 weeks. So if you want, I can come back on in 3 weeks and we can talk about how he turned another corner. Yeah, Rob Arthur at 538 did a great look at Harper's exit velocity over the last 2 years, and he found two interesting things. One is that Harper last year got a lot more production than we would predict based on his exit velocity. He was a great power hitter whose numbers nonetheless suggested that maybe, you know, he was hitting a lot of wall scrapers, I guess, mm-hmm. is the best way to put it. And there
exit
was
exit velocity being the speed of the
speed
ball
of the ball off the bat. Yeah, exactly. So there was probably some regression that was coming anyway, but he's not hitting the ball nearly as hard this year. He's especially not hitting the ball nearly as hard when it's right down the middle of the plate. He's been kind of an average hitter, which means that you can really sum up Bryce Harper's bad season in one sentence. He's not hitting the ball as hard. He is drawing a ton of walks. He's been a very valuable player and a very valuable hitter because of that, but he doesn't hit the ball as hard as he used to. And Harper's got a sort of a complicated swing. I mean, it's an unusual swing. It's a swing that you don't really see from other people. And so it's always possible. Like, I know that before he broke out last year, there was kind of an every year parlor game of looking at his swing and seeing if it had finally clicked. It's possible that there's something mechanical there, but I don't know. I mean, the Occam's razor here is that there's some injury. And Tom Verducci reported a week ago that a source told him that Harper's had a shoulder injury for the last 2 months, which is definitely the sort of injury that saps power. The Nationals denied it and said that, you know, Harper assured them that that wasn't the case. But players lie about injuries, or they use, you know, tricky language to cover up injuries. And that really seems like the most natural thing about it. I think that there's a feeling that when you see a 22-year-old do a great thing, that, well, he's just going to get better with age. We know that players peak a little later in their career than that. But if you have a season that is as good as Harper's is, if you have a sort of an all-time season, it's usually the best bet that they're not getting better, that sometimes you have your best season when you're 22. Sometimes you have your best season when you're 20. And so at Baseball Prospectus, we have this projection system called PECOTA that Nate Silver developed a long time ago. And this year we had a game at the site where you could try to beat PECOTA. You could pick all the players you thought were going to be better than PECOTA said, or all the players you thought were going to be worse than PECOTA said. And Bryce Harper was the most popular pick to be better than PECOTA said. Everybody thought, well, the system, the algorithm is too slow to adjust. He's clearly a better player who turned the corner, and the computers are too slow. And in fact, he is right now exactly what PECOTA said he was going to be, like exactly like to the thousandth. And so everybody was wrong. And
you got to shut off the system right now before he gets better. Shut it down. Unplug it.
It's reasonable to say that, well, you know, players do this. They get better and they get worse. And Harper last year had a better year than we probably should have expected from him. And now he's kind of regressed. I don't think that's the case. I actually think that PECOTA is wrong. I think Harper is better than this. I think he'll be better next year than he is this year, and better the year after that than he is this year.
Well, and as Jeff Sullivan pointed out on FanGraphs, Sam, there's a big element of luck here. When you hit a baseball, it's not all in your control. And Harper's numbers last year for batted balls in play and other advanced metrics indicated that he was really fortunate in where the ball was going when he hit it. And he has not had that kind of good luck with batted balls in play this year, air ball contact and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is kind of what we were talking about with Sanchez, too. The element of random fluctuation is kind of unfun to talk about when you're doing analysis of something. It's hard to just throw your hands up and go, well, you know, there's a lot of randomness to this game. But it is the most, I mean, it's like it's a, it is, if it is not the absolute main character in baseball, it is at least a strong supporting character in everything you do. There's so much fluctuation from day to day, from week to week. And, you know, if you look at how baseball works, a lot of times an out is an out because it was hit too hard. It was hit too hard to fall in front of the outfielder. And a lot of times a hit is a hit because it was hit too poorly for an outfielder to catch. And when you have a game built around that luck, then you're going to have a lot of weird swings. And right now Bryce Harper's going through a weird swing. I think even with all that, he's not hitting the ball as hard, and he's probably hurt, in my opinion. And that happens too. But Bryce Harper had the best season ever by a 19-year-old. He had the best season ever by a 22-year-old. He's having a disappointing 23-year-old season. If you were picking teams, he'd be probably the second or third guy you'd pick still.
Well, Gary Sanchez, of course, being the first.
Yeah, and Shane Spencer really right there with him.
Yeah.
Sam Miller, editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, co-host of the Effectively Wild podcast, chiseler of the Gary Sanchez Hall of Fame plaque. Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And I didn't get a chance to talk about this in our Kaepernick segment, but I was in Thailand a while back for a wedding. It was lovely. And went to a movie, because I like to go to movies in foreign countries, and was very surprised to hear the royal anthem of Thailand being played before the movie. And Thailand is very different place than the U.S. For example, according to the Wikipedia page for the Royal Anthem, in April 2008, it was reported that a Thai citizen was facing criminal charges for failing to stand for the playing of the Royal Anthem at a movie theater. And so obviously not an equivalent gesture to fail to stand for the Royal Anthem versus the national anthem in the U.S. as far as consequences faced. But I was just like so shocked that they played the, you know, anthem before a movie and like, oh, who does that? That's so weird. But it's really not any weirder than playing the national anthem before a sporting event. Right, Mina?
Back me up here.
No,
it is great. I mean, when you really put it in perspective, yeah. I mean, the NFL is the greatest show in America. It is entertainment. What makes it somehow more appropriate to honor the military at that event than a movie? I don't know. I don't really think there's a difference.
There's a royal anthem and a national anthem. The national anthem of Thailand is played on radio and television twice a day.
Our royal anthem in America, I think, is Beyonce's Lemonade at this point.
With that, what is your royal anthem, Mina?
So I'm just going to do what I did a year ago and just tell an awkward story about a article that I didn't write that doesn't reflect Volney. I was just in the Olympics in Rio for a couple of weeks. In addition to, you know, citing with Ryan Lochte, I was just kind of writing about some of the events there, especially women's sports. And we were staying in an apartment complex in basically what's the equivalent of Queens in Rio. And so I would just go to the same place for lunch every day. And I was walking to lunch, I think maybe on the third or fourth day I was in Rio. So this thing's rolling towards me and it's a bulldog on a skateboard. So where is this going? So I'm a dog lover. I really missed my dog at that point. So I'm like, oh, it's so cute. So I asked the guy if I can take a picture. I don't speak any Portuguese, but he lets me take a picture of this dog. A few days go by. I'm touring Rio with the group, and I'm talking to our driver about my dog, as I want to do. And I'm like, oh, funny thing. I saw this dog on a skateboard the other day. So I show him a picture, and he's like, oh, yeah, Cachorro Escatista. I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, they're everywhere. So in my head, I'm like, oh, my God, I just found the stray dogs of Sochi, the skateboarding dogs of Rio. My editor is going to go wild for this. So I proceed to waste the next 24 hours looking for Cachorro Escatista. And he's right. There are a ton of these dogs in Brazil. In fact, I think it might be a Latin American thing because there was that famous bulldog who skateboarded through people's legs. I don't know if you remember that video or GIF on the internet. And that turned out it was in Peru. So I'm like, maybe this is a thing here. So I start contacting people. Don't hear back, probably because I didn't contact them in Portuguese. It's not a good reporting method. So I go to the park and I'm going up to people with dogs and trying to ask them if their dogs skateboard, but I don't speak Portuguese. So I'm mimicking the dog on a skateboard. People are like, what is wrong with you? Get away from my dog. Don't touch my dog. So I do this for like a day and I'm like, you know what? I'm about to give up. So I decided to go to a skate park and my editor is like, or maybe you could cover one of the Olympic sports. So I give up on the story. I'm like, you know what? This is just not going to happen. Then on the last day, I left after 2 weeks. I'm rolling my suitcase out. What do I see? Another skateboarding dog. I'm not sure if I dreamed it up. It may have been like a fever dream on the way out. So I'm asking listeners in Brazil, if you know the owner of a skateboarding dog, you know, it only takes three to make a trend, please contact me. I still believe this is going to be my Pulitzer winning story.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. You
got to pursue this to the ends of the earth.
Thank you.
Stefan, what is your royal anthem?
Well, in the third play of a preseason game against Mina's Seattle Seahawks last Thursday, a Dallas quarterback Tony Romo was hit and he grabbed his back, according to Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio, quote, like Fred Sanford clutching his chest in anticipation of the big one. But I'm not here to reminisce about 1970s sitcoms, though, for the record, I did love Sanford and Son. Let's look instead at the five stages of grief response to the injury from Cowboys owner Jerry Jones and head coach Jason Garrett. After the game, Romo said he was fine, because athletes always say they're fine. Garrett said he was fine too. Said a few prayers right there, Jones said. He said Romo's back was in good shape and everyone had a scare and he was not hurt. Garrett said, initially, I think he was in a little bit of shock. He didn't feel real good. But once a little time went by, I think he was feeling better, better, and better. here. We don't think there's anything serious. Bear in mind that Romo's back had not been MRI'd or X-rayed, and as any NFL player will tell you, your initial reaction to an injury is to pretend that it didn't happen. Mid-afternoon Friday, ESPN's Ed Werder tweets, Tony Romo, broken bone in back. So in 18 hours, we went from definitively not hurt to broken back. Garrett refused to rule Romo out for the season opener, though. On Saturday, Ian Rappaport of NFL.com reported that Romo would likely need an epidural if he was going to play, because it's always smart to numb an injured back and then let 300-pound guys fall on you. Later the same Saturday came news that Romo actually had a compression fracture of his L1 vertebra and was expected to be out for 6 to 10 weeks. And he was wearing a back brace. And still Garrett wouldn't rule him out for game one. We've gotten a lot of different timetables for when he can return. We also know that he's played with a broken bone in his back before, so there's no reason for me to stand up here and put a timetable on this. Yes, he's played with a broken back before, so why not play with one again? Jerry added, this is nowhere near the issue he had last year, not even in the same league as far as we're concerned. Last year's issue was a broken collarbone. All right, if throwing is your job, maybe a broken collarbone is indeed in a league of its own. But this is Romo's fourth back injury in 3 years. In 2014, he suffered two fractures that didn't require surgery. In 2013, he had a cyst removed in the spring, and then he had surgery for a herniated disc. With a game left in the season. Let's take a look at how Garrett and Jones handled that break, which resulted from an apparent kick to his back. Afterward, Jones said Romo had tightness. The next day, Adam Schefter of ESPN reported that Romo was out for the next game. Jones, though, denied it. Romo only had back spasms. There's nothing structurally to prevent him from playing, Jones said on his radio show. Garrett added, right now we have a quarterback who's getting treatment. The best part of all this was that while talking about Romo's medical condition, Jones cited HIPAA patient confidentiality laws for declining to give further details. In any event, 3 days later, Romo had surgery, which Jones dismissed. The nature of his injury was not alarming. It was not complicated. All right, in both 2013 and 2016, Jerry and Jason moved on immediately to praise the next quarterback up and stress how this was not the end for Romo. It is the five stages of grief in three quick news cycles. As I type this, we are in the home stretch of acceptance. We love Tony. Tony's great. Tony's coming back. But yeah. Dak Prescott is the man. All right, look, whether he quits now or later, Tony Romo is going to be fucked up from football for the rest of his life. Meanwhile, the NFL's HIPAA-violating, anti-inflammatory injecting, and opioid-pushing owners and coaches and doctors will keep minimizing injuries and ignoring the long-term health consequences for players, all while emphasizing the truly important cost of an injury to a Tony Romo. Quote, really just couldn't imagine getting that hand dealt to us, Jerry said after Romo was hurt last week. To us, poor fucking you, Jerry. Poor fucking you.
Do you think if Tony Romo was no longer alive, Jerry Jones would push like a Weekend at Bernie's scenario and just drag him onto the field?
Drag him onto the field. He's fine. He's fine.
Guys, he's smiling. Put sunglasses on him.
He's played dead before.
The broken back always does it for me. And it's happened for Romo so many times. Just how common is it to hear he has a broken bone in his back, he can play through it? That one always cracks me up.
I can't watch him anymore. I don't know how you guys feel. It's definitely in Wes Welker territory for me, where when they trot him out on the field, I'm just cringing so hard that I no longer enjoy. And I think he's excellent.
He's fine.
That's like 85% of the NFL.
He'll be fine.
Josh, what's your royal anthem?
On Sunday, the Washington Post's Cindy Boren wrote a piece headlined Colin Kaepernick Protest Has 49ers Fans Burning Their Jerseys. Lest you accuse her of false pluralization, there are indeed, she does cite two examples of people burning Kaepernick jerseys. This is a ritual every time a player says or does something controversial. One or maybe two people, if it's a real outrage, make a show of burning said player's jersey, putting it on Facebook. And then the dreaded sports media fans the flames. But as we poke our Kaepernick jerseys with the set of fireplace tools we've reserved for just this occasion, let's pause to remember the player who once burned his own jersey. On May 12th, 1971, Dick Wade of the Kansas City Star reported that the Royals clubhouse was closed after the game, which was very unusual. When reporters were finally admitted, Wade wrote, "The cause and effect was all too evident. The room was filled with thick, acrid smoke, and the remnants of burned baseball equipment was in front of Carl Taylor's locker." Taylor had had an interesting week. 2 days before, he dived to catch a ball, and the umpire had ruled he trapped it rather than caught it cleanly. Taylor charged at the ump, and when his teammate Cookie Rojas tried to get between them, Taylor knocked Rojas to the ground. Boys will be boys, though, so Taylor was still in the lineup against the Orioles 2 days later. After starting the game 0-for-2 with a strikeout and a groundout, Taylor pulled himself from the game. According to AP reports from the following day, he told his manager, Bob Lemon, "I quit," then burned all of his equipment. According to the AP, Taylor, who was hitting 189 at the time, said, "I can't take any more. I'm not helping this club." Taylor was the stepbrother of Orioles first baseman Boog Powell, which, you know, makes you wonder why he didn't start his own barbecue stand. Perhaps a better synergy there.
He was already experienced with flames.
They played together, Boog and Carl, in the 1954 Little League World Series. Not for Korea. And Powell and Taylor were playing against each other. It was Royals and Orioles in these games. Powell said in an interview 2 days later, "I talked and talked to him for about 45 minutes. I talked my head off. I didn't want him to go. He's a good kid. I tried to get him to rationalize the whole thing." That's not what that means. "To think about what was at stake. I live only 8 blocks from the ballpark, and I said to him, 'Come on back home with me. We'll have a couple of beers and talk this thing out. Whatever the problem is, it can't be that bad.' But it was no use. He was dead set." So I found this column from the Sarasota Herald Tribune, November 15th, 1972, that explains what Carl Taylor was thinking. The Keeping Score column by Alan Lucilla. We've all read it. He writes, "Normally a consistent hitter, Taylor was in the throes of a batting slump early in the season. His mother was seriously ill with a terminal disease, and then he misplayed a ball in the outfield. Burning the sweatshirt was a release. I realize now that I was more concerned with my personal problems than with playing baseball," Taylor said. "I was playing terrible. I just went to the clubhouse and burned the uniform. Most of the players understood. They've all wanted to do something like that at one time or another." The column goes on to describe him flying home to Sarasota to be with his family, sitting in Key West, where he'd grown up, sitting in the ballpark in Key West for an hour, just thinking, "My whole life passed before me, all the memories from my high school days. I realized I had received too much and had given too much to give up baseball. That changed my attitude." He went back to the Royals, went to AAA. He was traded again to the Pirates for cash before the season was over. The Pirates won the World Series, but he was traded too late to be on the roster. Carl Taylor was out of baseball a couple years later, ended hitting 266 and 846 at-bats between 1968 and 1973, later became the video coordinator for the Yankees, and according to the Yankees media guide circa the 90s, threw batting practice and was the club's, quote, resident barber. So no barbecue stand for Carl Taylor. Barbershop instead. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We've also gathered links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe in iTunes to the podcast and give us a rating. It helps us out. Give us a comment and a rating. iTunes.com/slatepodcast is where you do that. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Thanks to Mina Kimes for sitting in this week. Our producer is Mickey Kapper. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.